So good morning, one and all.
Good morning. Welcome.
Today I thought I'd talk about trees, which may seem a little odd to talk about trees, but trees have been so important in the Buddhist Dharma. And when I sat down to begin to think about this, I thought, first of all, well, what is a tree? What is a tree? Because trees are not a taxonic group, right? There's a number of plant species that kind of fit in this category that we commonly kind of refer to as trees. And when I did a little research, I realized that the botanical definitions about what is a tree vary. But in general, a tree is considered to be, first of all, of course, a perennial plant, one that keeps going for a number of years, has some kind of elongated stem or trunk, and supports branches which have leaves or needles. Some other definitions I found limit trees to woody plants or to plants that are usable as lumber and above a specific height. Perhaps we could say, I know a tree when I see one, rather than trying to define it clearly. I don't know if I've mentioned this one time or another at another talk, but St. Augustine, one of the great kind of Christian philosophers, said, when you don't ask me, I know what time is. But when you ask me, I really don't know what time is. You know, when we try to figure out these, like, what do we really mean by time? It's like, well, wait a minute, what is it? I think trees are maybe a little bit the same. Trees. In so many of the world's spiritual religious traditions, trees have quite a prominent role. I remember when I first arrived in Japan, here and there, there were, particularly in Shinto shrines, but also in around Buddhist temples, there would be these large trees, and some of them wrapped in straw, kind of woven straw in a certain way, kind of marking them as sacred, marking them as the places where spirits reside. And in the early Buddhist texts, we find also the Buddha talked about the spirits that live in some trees. In fact, the Metta Sutta that we chant, according to legend, began when the Buddha was giving instruction to his monks who had kind of been chased out of their grove where they would go and meditate, but the spirits were kind of unsure about who these strange monks were. And so the Buddha taught them the Metta Sutta to chant and soothe the spirits of the trees. Trees. Strong and silent. Many of them outliving the human lifespan by many, many years. They bear a silent witness to our lives. Generation after generation, reminding us to bear witness to our own life. With their roots kind of deep in the earth, where their crowns kind of reach toward the heavens, trees connect heaven and earth. So I think in these ways and in others, it's really natural that over the centuries we have turned to them for connection to this world of spirit and world of the material. And we have sought from trees understanding and solace. But of course, as we all know in contemporary times, our connection with trees has become weak. And yet, even today, children are often very aware of this strong connection with trees. Children are attracted to trees and find comfort, you know, sitting at the base of a tree or in the branches. Have you ever climbed a tree? When I was a child growing up in Calgary, there were no big trees around where I lived. We kind of lived always on the outskirts for some reason. Calgary has pathetic trees in general, but there are some big ones there too now. But anyway, when I was a young boy, there were no trees I could climb. And then our family, for a brief while, moved to a farm in England. And in England, climbable trees abound, oaks, chestnuts, etc. In one field, just outside the house where we lived, and I think it was an oak, there was one single tree in the middle. I think it had been placed there to provide shade for the grazing animals, with big lower limbs in this wide pasture. And I would climb on this tree every day, over and over again. And the tree, I realize now, it really called out to me. And it, sitting on its limbs, I felt safe. In our Zen tradition, we have a story about climbing and sitting in trees. Bojui, lived in the 700s, was a great Chinese poet of the Tang Dynasty. In fact, he's known as one of the great three, the three great poets of China. David, you may look him up. When he was a governor in a certain district in China, he heard that there was a Zen teacher in his jurisdiction that he was looking at. And this Zen teacher was popularly known as Bird's Nest, or Bird's Nest Teacher, because this teacher used to practice meditation in a tree on a seat made of kind of thickly grown branches, and maybe he added a little bit to himself, a little padding. But he would climb up in this tree and meditate every day. And so Bojui, this kind of governor poet, decided to visit him. And so he made the journey and came to the base of the tree, looked up, and there's Bird's Nest. And Bojui called out, "Hey, looks pretty dangerous up there." And Bird's Nest looked down and said, "Your position is far more dangerous than mine." Bojui replied, "Hey, I'm the governor of this district. I don't see any danger in that." "Then you don't know yourself. When your passions burn and your mind is unsteady, what is more dangerous than that?" Now, I suspect Bojui probably reflected on this wisdom a little bit, and maybe also on the knowledge that working for the emperor was a pretty dangerous job overall, emperors being pretty fickle in general. Anyway, Bojui had come a long way to see this Bird's Nest Roshi and wanted some instruction in the Buddha Dharma. So he looked up again and he asked, "What is the teaching of all the Buddhas?" Simple question, eh? "What is the teaching of all the Buddhas?" And Bird's Nest recited the famous stanza from the Dhammapada, which is one of the earliest texts of the Buddhist tradition. "Avoid all evil, practice good, purify your mind. That's the teaching of all Buddhas." Now, I suspect Bojui must have been rather disappointed at such a brief teaching after he thought up this great question to ask. and made this long journey. So he protested. Any 3-year-old child knows this. And Bird's Nest replied, yeah. Any 3-year-old child may know it, but even an old man of 80 years finds it difficult to practice. And so concluded Bird's Nest, sitting up in his tree. But I think it's really fitting that Bird's Nest offered Bojui the foundation of the Buddhist teaching to live a wholesome life and observe the mind while sitting in a tree. Because trees are steady, observant beings that stand in one spot for decades or hundreds of years, watching all that flows by without getting entangled by it. They model for us the practice of mindfulness and stability. But I think they also gift us with a sense of belonging and a sense of ease. Walking in a wood or along a forest trail, our busyness of mind or our despair or our sadness lightens. And often we enter into the lightness of possibility. In Japan, walking in woods has become a form of therapy known as Shinrin Yoku, which translates as forest bathing. And the therapy was developed in Japan starting around the 1980s. And today, it's really recognized as a very important part of preventative healthcare and healing in the Japanese medicine. And although, you know, we have known this for hundreds of years intuitively, researchers in Japan, and particularly Korea, South Korea, have established now quite a large body of scientific literature on the health benefits of spending time under the canopy of a living forest. It's not clear yet what all the beneficial factors are, but some research has clearly shown the colors and the fragrance of the forest may be key elements. The aromatic compounds from trees called phytoncides can increase a type of white blood cell that supports the immune system, for example. And many of the studies they've done show that a simple 2-hour walk in woods dramatically lowers stress, anxiety, and blood pressure. Who knew, eh? Well, really, didn't we all know? This means it's not really new knowledge. You know, go walk in the woods and you feel better. Our ancestors have long known that spending time with trees brings ease and comfort. Trees invite us to stop moving and spend time under their canopy. They remind us of the beauty of life that is lived just in the present moment without all of our entangled thoughts. Trees are really prominent in early Buddhist literature. The Buddha, being a sensitive and observant person, spent much of his time in forests and developed a great appreciation and a great knowledge of trees. Many of the Buddha's discourses show that he had a particular love of trees, which is not surprising, really, given that his life from the moment of his birth to his death has always was intimately connected with trees. Buddha's mother, Queen Maya, gave birth to Siddhartha, who would become the Buddha, in Lumbini Grove, a grove of sal trees. These large trees, Shaurya Robusta, for those of you who want to know the Latin. And the text goes like this. The whole of Lumbini Grove was like a wood of variegated creepers, or the well-decorated banquet hall of some mighty king. Queen, beholding it, was filled with desire of resting herself in the sal tree grove, and the attendants carrying the queen entered the wood. She came to the monarch sal tree of the glade, right, the main kind of mother tree of the glade. She wanted to take hold of a branch of it, and the branch bending down like a reed heated by steam approached within the reach of her hand, and reaching out her hand, she took hold of the branch. And then karma-born winds shook her, and the people, her people, drawing a curtain around her, retired. Standing and holding the branch of a sal tree, she was delivered of her child. Now, another major event connected with trees was when young Siddhartha, he's probably a teenager, had his first deep spiritual experience while sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree. It was his memory of this unprompted experience that he had that spurred him when he was on his spiritual journey to drop his severe ascetic practices as unfruitful and instead just enter into deep meditation. So this is another quote, again, that time when he was in the midst of doing all of these strong ascetic practices and struggling and very close to death, according to the texts. So he said this, I thought of the time when my Sakyan father was working and I was sitting in the shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded, cool, and free from sensual appetites, secluded from unwholesome things. I had entered an abode in the first meditation, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring, with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion, and thus I saw it. Haven't we all had kind of similar experiences, just sitting somewhere quietly, suddenly just feeling at ease and at peace, maybe under a great tree? And then, of course, there's the tree associated with Siddhartha's great awakening when he became the Buddha. Having given up his really severe ascetic practices, Siddhartha went to a place that we know today as Bodh Gaya. And there he took nourishment and sat under a tree for 7 days and seven nights. And when at last he experienced full awakening, penetrating the deepest truth of existence, he arose. That tree is known as the Bodhi tree, the tree of awakening. And scholars today believe it was a variety of fig, and known to botanists as the Ficus religiosae, in honor of the Buddha. It's quite a beautiful tree. Large spreading branches provide shade, and the leaves are kind of rounded, but they come with a kind of a pointed tip. Wish Brian was here. Apparently there's one up at UBC, that a small one that they have grown. And after he had this strong experience, the Buddhist tradition has it that the Buddha remained under the Bodhi tree for another 7 days. Kind of contemplating and gazing at it frequently out of gratitude for the shelter and support it had offered him. Now, I did a little more research and I read that the original tree was destroyed by a local king during his persecution of Buddhism in the 2nd century in BCE. But an offshoot of that original tree was preserved in Sri Lanka. And over the many centuries, shoots of that tree that is still in Sri Lanka has been replanted in Bodh Gaya twice. And the last time was in 1881 by a British archaeologist after the last tree had died of old age. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm. That one's still alive?
That one's still alive. So if we go to Bodh Gaya, we'll see that one. 1881. It's clear from the old text that the Buddha considered forests to be good places to live and to spend time and meditate in. And very often he would say to his disciples, Here are the roots of the trees. Here are the empty spaces. Meditate. This is my instruction to you. It's written that the Buddha frequently sought lodgings in the forest, in the depths of jungles, in quiet places. He encouraged many of his disciples to spend the whole year amongst trees, except for the 3 months of the monsoon. He said, spend them at the roots of trees in the open air. Spend your time there. So clearly the Buddha saw great value in living by or living near trees. When I used to go to Great Vow Monastery down in Oregon, they have a lovely monastery and grounds, an old school that's been converted. Jan Chosen Bays, one of the teachers there, would encourage people at the retreats to meditate outside, to take up your meditation posture under trees by placing a piece of cardboard box and then a cushion on top and sit there under a tree and meditate. I remember her saying, this is what the Buddha recommended. Try it. She also encouraged retreatants to do meditation outside at night in the forests. They had woods, not really forests. It's kind of a rural, gentle area. It's not wild. Although many people were scared to go out at night and sit in the woods. Because dark, sometimes very dark, you need a flashlight. And then you would hear. You go. So she encouraged us to sit outside at night under trees in the woods, and also to bring our deepest questions to trees. Bring our deepest questions to trees. I'm very grateful to her for these practices of sitting outside under trees, of asking trees the deep questions. I have found them so helpful during trying times, and I recommend them to you. So after his long teaching career, the Buddha, in pain and near death, went to the sal tree grove of the Malayans near Kushinagara and lay down between two great sal trees. And very close to death, the Buddha addressed his monks. I exhort you, monks, all fabrications are subject to decay. Bring about completion by being heedful. Practice, right? Practice. And those were the Buddha's last words. I imagine sometimes what it would be like to die outside, under great trees standing watch. And I, for one, would greatly prefer this to a hospital room. And then throughout the Buddhist texts, we find trees used as a metaphor for compassion and for giving. One early text says, we should emulate trees. It gives this as the reason. As a tree makes no distinction in the shade it gives, like this, the meditator should make no distinction between any beings, but develop love equally to all, whether thieves, murderers, or enemies, and to himself or herself. Isn't that interesting? Very clear, right? Develop love for all beings. And don't forget the one that's sitting on the cushion. Don't forget that one. You may, you know, include all the drug addicts and everyone else you're having trouble with, but don't forget the one sitting on the cushion doing this. So a tree welcomes all into its shade, of course. And in ancient India, shade was a great gift. In another text, the Buddha encourages the planting of fruit trees along roadsides to offer shade and food for travelers. And one more text, A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life by the great teacher, Shantideva, and poet, I should mention too, a great teacher and poet, Shantideva. He wrote of his longing for the peace of the forest with these words. He said, "The trees do not speak harsh words, nor do they try to please by artifice. When shall I have the opportunity to dwell with those happy to live with the trees?" It's a question I often ask myself about halfway through a school term. So what's so special about trees? Now you may think, well, a tree is simply an insentient being providing us with shade, clean air, paper products, looks nice. But a tree, of course, is so much more. Recent research tells us that trees speak sophisticated silent language, communicating complex information via smell, taste, and electrical impulses. I recently read a book. Susan had given us a book by Peter Wallenberg. I brought it and I forgot to show you here, who describes some of these ways of communication. And he gives one example about how trees communicate through olfactory warning systems. And he says scientists noted something on the African savanna. The giraffes were feeding on thorn acacias, and the trees didn't like this one bit. And it took the acacias mere minutes to start pumping toxic substances into their leaves to rid them of the large herbivores. And the giraffes got the message and moved on to other trees in the vicinity. But they didn't move on to the trees close by. They walked away about 100 yards to start feeding again, because the acacia trees that were being eaten also gave off a warning gas to warn the other trees nearby that signaled them that a crisis was at hand. And so right away, all the forewarned trees also started pumping out these same bitter toxins to discourage these large herbivores. And like us, most trees are social beings. Scientists have discovered that neighboring trees help each other through their root systems, either directly by intertwining and connecting roots, or indirectly by these fungal networks around the roots that serve as a kind of extended nervous system connecting separate trees. Again, Wallenberg writes, why do they share food with their own species and sometimes even go as far to nourish their competitors? So these trees are giving each other sugars. The reasons are the same as for human communities. There are advantages to working together. A tree is not a forest. On its own, a tree cannot establish a consistent local climate. It's at the mercy of wind and weather. But together, many trees create an ecosystem that moderates extreme heat and cold, stores a great deal of water, and generates a great deal of humidity. And in this protective environment, trees can live to be very old. To get to this point, the community must remain intact no matter what. Every tree, therefore, is valuable to the community and worth keeping around for as long as possible. And that is why even sick individuals are supported and nourished until they recover by other trees. Trees are connected to each other through underground fungal networks. Trees share water and nutrients through these networks and also use them to communicate. Just going to skip a little bit more. Oh yeah, here we are. And how do they communicate? Through these networks, trees send chemical, hormonal, and slow pulsing electrical signals, which scientists are just beginning to discover. This one scientist, Susan Simnard, a forest ecology professor at UBC, has established the existence of these electrical alive fungal root networks, now called the Wood Wide Web. And what's interesting is this researcher, Simnard, has traced this web across species boundaries. Birches and Douglas firs supply each other with carbon and nutriments, while taking seasonal turns as the dominant partner in the exchange. Cool. Wow. So they're, who's got the juice, they share it back and forth. Wow. And she noticed when the Douglas firs dies, the birches tend to die off nearby, and it was vice versa. They're living together in community. I wonder if our Chinese ancestors understood this in some way. For in Chinese Buddhism, the word forest is often used to represent a monastery, people living together and supporting each other. But it's not just the historical connection with trees in Buddhist lore or the strong affinity that the Buddha had with trees that has drawn Buddhist practitioners into woods and forests throughout the centuries. I think it's the slow pace of tree life and the unceasing teachings that they offer us when we slow down. Dogen Zenji, the Japanese teacher who brought this form of Buddhism from China to Japan way back in the 1200s, wrote this. He said, "Grasses and trees, fences and walls demonstrate and exalt deep, wondrous dharma for the sake of living beings, both ordinary and sage." Dogen wrote that in his view, what we call inanimate is really dynamically active. And gifting us with awakening. Trees exalt the deep, wondrous dharma for the sake of living beings, both ordinary and sage. And Dogen calls on us to see the interconnected nature of all things, that we are part of a web that includes what we so carelessly consider not us. When we see a great Douglas fir or ancient cedar, we're moved by how fully and completely, perfectly they are trees. The great cedar or Douglas fulfills and expresses its nature and is awesome. And then when we climb the North Shore Mountains and at the top see a stunted and twisted tree made so by the elements, is it any less a tree? Is its nature any the less? Young, old, bent, straight, strong, weak, sick, healthy, thin, stocky, is our nature any the less? Trees offer us countless teachings. What would the oldest tree, a bristlecone pine named Methuselah, with its 4,789 rings, tell us if we sat under it for a while? The location of that tree is secret. Very few people know about it in order to protect it. A tree almost 5,000 years old. And what about the quaking aspen forest known as the Pando clone, made up of 47,000 tree trunks covering 106 acres, and yet it is a single organism that began life as a single seed, possibly thousands of years ago. Each trunk of this great forest is genetically identical and no more than 150 years old. But the root system may be the oldest living organism on the planet. What made it tell us about life if we sat there for a while? It is, of course, in their silence that trees speak most strongly. Trees tell us what is unsaid or cannot be said if we're willing to sit and stand with them for a while. We miss much of what is of the essence in our hurried world. Trees, in their seemingly silent standing, remind us. They remind us that everything is constantly and fully showing itself to us, alive and connected. Each moment has a spark. What we call mundane is nothing more than our dull blindness speaking. What is a tree? Please go outside after this and ask a tree, who are you? And while you're there, also ask, who am I? And I wonder what it will say back to you. Thank you.